Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. It's my great pleasure to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. We have here tonight a discussion between Sarah Granger, an author and digital media entrepreneur, and Scott Allen Morrison, the author of a novel, Terms of Use, which predicted that there would be a problem if Facebook started to use its power in political election years, which turned out to happen this year, which was a nice thing for his book. So, and not a nice thing for the rest of us. So Sarah is going to introduce herself and Scott and discuss with them. We will have a Q&A, as we always do, when their discussion is done, and I will use the mic and bring it around for everybody. So if you have a question, just raise your hand, and I'll bring it to you. Sarah.
Good evening. So tonight we're going to have a great conversation, and I'm very excited that a lot of the themes in terms of use are of personal interest to me. Just a little bit about my background so you can frame the conversation. I've been online since I was 9 years old and coding since then too, and I went from IT security to internet startups and then into social media strategy, including working for political organizations and campaigns. So that's the tie-in. And I'm also an author. My book is called The Digital Mystique, How the Culture of Connectivity Can Empower Your Life Online and Off. So my experiences with social media and security have been largely positive, but not without a lot of hard-learned lessons along the way. So needless to say, I was thrilled to have this opportunity, and we're going to have a lot of fun talking about these important issues. Now about Scott. He grew up in Canada and Mexico, and he also lived in Southeast Asia, so a lot of these places are referenced in his book, in addition to San Francisco, which one of my favorite scenes is in a diner. San Francisco diner, of course. And I think it's also fascinating that Scott studied computer science before choosing to get a degree in journalism, so there's a little bit of that you'll notice also about the book. He's been a journalist for 20 years, and he has been a correspondent for Financial Times, Dow Jones Newswires, contributor to the Wall Street Journal, the Daily Beast, covering mostly major tech companies for 10 years. And I think it's safe to say that as an experienced journalist, he did his homework to make Terms of Use a very realistic story. So to our first question.
You.
Yeah. 10 years is a long time to cover Silicon Valley. And then you choose to make the leap to fiction, writing a thriller about the dark side of social media. What prompted you to undertake this project?
Well, there was no one event that prompted me. But during those 10 years, I had a front row seat to the growth of the Internet. I watched a lot of these companies that we now take for granted grow up. One of the general themes that I covered quite closely was the rise of what we then called user-generated content. You remember 10 years ago, we got online and we started blogging, and we could look at all these cool videos, and we could communicate with our friends on these social network sites. You know, we had YouTube, and if you remember back then, the big hot social network of the time was this company called MySpace. And of course, Google was already the 800-pound gorilla, or maybe it's the 900-pound gorilla, I don't know, with this very ambitious mission to organize the world's information. And it was a very exciting time for all of us online. And the Internet suddenly gave us a new voice that we didn't have before. Enabled us to make better decisions than we could before because we had more information at our fingertips. We were more creative, and we were more productive at work. So it was very exciting, and the best of all is that these services were all free. We could use them, and we didn't have to pay a dime, and all we had to do was allow these companies to collect and analyze our data. And why? What they told us was so they could send us ads that we wanted to see. We would never again have to look at an ad that we didn't want to see. And that was the tacit bargain we made with these companies. We allowed them to have our data for free services. And best of all, they were going to respect our privacy. So I ask you, who here believes that today? All right, so you guys are pretty cynical, which is good. I don't have to work too hard tonight. There was a poll last year by the Pew Research Center that found two-thirds of Americans, and I'd like to know who the other third is, but two-thirds of Americans do not trust online video sites, social networks, search engines, and advertisers to protect and respect our privacy. So I would have a lot of conversations with these companies, and I'd ask about privacy, and I'd ask how we knew that they were going to treat our data with the respect that I think it deserved. And they would just say, well, we would never do that. We would never do something untoward with your data. Trust us. And being a cynical journalist, I didn't really trust them. So I started thinking long and hard about what could people do? What could bad actors do with our data? So it became sort of a thought exercise, and you know, how bad could it get if the wrong people were in control of our data? And I finally decided that I had to write a novel, because you can't really write a news story about that, because it hasn't happened. Well, it hadn't happened yet. I'm not entirely sure that it's happened yet, but it's certainly a distinct possibility now, and I think we all understand that possibility. So that's really what sort of led me to this point.
It's fascinating. So on that note, there are a lot of striking parallels between terms of use and the current, both the climate of the industry, but also particularly this election. To what degree was any of that intentional when you were writing?
Well, I certainly didn't foresee Donald Trump or this current campaign. I actually thought this book would be done before the election. The sad thing about novels is that they take a long time. And certainly the first one took a lot longer than I thought. So I really thought this novel would be released before the election. So the striking parallels, as George knows, it's actually pretty good for me. but when I thought about how I was going to explore this scenario and think about what bad actors could do, I wanted to create a storyline that we could all relate to, that mattered to us, and sort of the preservation of our democracy, I think we can all agree is a pretty important aspect in our lives, and we need to think long and hard about how social media could affect our political discourse and our free will to determine who is our government. And I wanted to create a scenario that was scary enough that people would react to viscerally, hopefully, as they read the story. So the fact that there are some striking parallels, I'm happy about it, but I'm also kind of disturbed about the fact that it's actually, some of it's coming true so quickly.
Yeah. Although the book has been described as a page-turner, and it really is. I enjoyed reading it and felt that way. And I think I would have felt that way regardless of what's happening right now. But it does make you think. Every once in a while I would stop and go, okay, well, there are some parallels to what's happening right now.
It proves that I wasn't just being paranoid.
So when I first started working with political campaigns on social media, it wasn't even prevalent enough to sway elections. Really, just getting people to put a website up was a big challenge. But in recent years, it's really shifted toward people. Everyone is online now. We hear about the social media echo chamber, to your point earlier, and the manner in which our conversations now happen in silos, whether they are about candidates or other issues. What do you make of this and how it affects our dialogue?
Well, I'm very concerned about it, I guess. We are losing what I like to call the public square, and it's not a term that I've coined. It's just it's out there. The loss of the public square sort of refers to the loss of our ability to sort of share a common discourse. It's a figurative place where we all come together and debate the important issues that affect us all, and hopefully we can come to a consensus and move forward together. And we're not doing that anymore. The right wing and the left wing are talking past each other, or at least they're going around in circles in these echo chambers. You just have to look at Fox News and CNBC, MSNBC, and you can see the distinct tone, the distinct facts, the distinct arguments that they make, two different conversations. TV has played its role, but the internet has amplified it to the nth degree. We see that with and we've been talking about social media, but it's not just social media. Like Google, when you look at the search results, they provide you search results that I think we all know here are filtered to reflect our interests. Does anyone not understand that? And same thing with the news we get on Google. It is filtered to reflect things that we've expressed an interest in prior searches and on Google. Facebook does the same thing with what we see or don't see in the news feed. I lost my train of thought here. Yeah. The common square. Facebook is sort of the one that gets a lot of grief because it is such a big site and so many people get their news from Facebook now. There have been a lot of polls, but one of the more recent ones that I saw was 44% of Americans get news from Facebook, which if you do the math, that's 140 million Americans, which is about the size of the number of people that are going to vote this election, get their news from Facebook. And it's not just the news. It's, you know, they share messages, they share videos, they share links. They share these really nasty memes. We've all seen those little pictures with things written on the bottom about Clinton or about Trump. And we sort of see things in this echo chamber. We get pummeled by it over and over and over again. And again, our feeds are designed to reflect. We see what we have expressed an interest in, and we don't see things that we don't want to see. And people are lazy. We don't necessarily go beyond what we are fed on our news, on our Facebook feed. So that's problematic, I think, in its own right, because we're losing the public square. But consider an even scarier option is that our news feed, what we see or what we don't see, would be determined by other parameters, not what we want to see, but what they want us to see. Sounds really kind of ominous, but there have been a couple of incidents this year that suggest that maybe I am not being as paranoid as I initially thought I was. Has everyone heard of the trending topic scandal on Facebook? Does everyone know what I'm referring to? Okay. So I guess it was about March. There was a news story on a blog site called Gizmodo. It's a tech blog. It's a well-respected blog. And they revealed that Facebook has this section called Trending Topics, and it highlights the current topics that people are discussing and sharing and the hottest items on Facebook at any given time. And it was supposed to be determined by algorithm. But Gizmodo revealed that Facebook was actually using human curators, real people, to decide what was going to go on that trending topic list. And there was a set of criteria, and one of the criteria that they used was to sort of reflect credible news sources, i.e. the New York Times, Washington Post, The Guardian, sort of the mainstream media, if you will. And what was really scandalous about this allegation, or this piece, was an allegation by one of the curators that Facebook was suppressing conservative views on trending topics. So if it was a story about that was, say, pro-Trump, for example, but from a site that wasn't considered mainstream media, a human curator might be able to take it off that list and replace it with something from a liberal news source that might not be so pro-Trump. Not surprisingly, the right wing was outraged, and I did a dozen, if not more, radio interviews with very irate right-wing talk show radio hosts, and it was really quite interesting, actually. So Facebook went into damage control mode. They reacted very, very quickly. First of all, they denied that they were influencing what was going on and suppressing views on their news feed, on their trending topics feed. They also had a summit. They invited all these conservative leaders to come to show them how it worked. And they launched an investigation. And little by little, they have eliminated the human element in their trending topics section. And I think this week or next week, they will completely eliminate the human news curator role at Facebook. But it highlights a couple of things that we need to sort of think about. One is that in reality, Facebook is a media company. They claim they're an independent, neutral platform. But they make decisions about what we see all the time, whether through humans or whether through their algorithms. And Facebook is adamant adamantly opposed to calling themselves a media company. I mean, they get very upset when people do. But it's something like this, I think, highlights just how influential they are. But their argument that their algorithms make the decisions is false, too. I mean, these are not independent algorithms. Algorithms reflect the biases of the humans that write them. An algorithm is like a recipe or a formula to get from A to B. But you have to decide what B is. And the person that writes that formula decides where they want to get. And that reflects who that person is, where they come from, their background, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there are a lot of decisions, a lot of assumptions that are made along the way from getting from point A to point B, again, reflecting the biases of the people that write those programs. And then you stuff in all the data that this algorithm has to churn to come out with the answer at point B. And if that data is a historical set that is 20 years old, and let's say it's employment data, there's a fair chance that that might be a bit sexist, right? Because it reflects the job roles that women and men have had, the disparity in income, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that algorithm is going to spit out somewhat sexist results as a result of the data that has been input into it. So these algorithms are not objective whatsoever. And we need to be cognizant of this when we look at our news feeds and we try to figure out what we're seeing and why we're seeing it. There was another little scandal just prior to the trending topic scandal at Facebook. And this one was also a story in Gizmodo. And a little background. Facebook has an all-hands meeting every week in which employees get to ask Mark Zuckerberg sort of questions of the day. But because there are so many employees, they submit their questions, they're put on a list, and they get to vote for those questions. And the top 5 or 10 or whatever are asked at the weekly meeting. So it was revealed by Gizmodo that one of the questions that made it to the list sometime early this spring, in the middle of the campaign, was the following question. What responsibility does Facebook have to prevent a President Trump in 2016? So I'm going to repeat that again. So what responsibility does Facebook have to prevent a President Trump in 2016? Now, I'm going to guess probably not a lot of Trump supporters here, but it's a frightening question to think about that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people at Facebook who think it's their role to influence the outcome of the election. Pretty scandalous, I think. We don't know if that question was actually asked at the meeting. And if it was, we don't know how Zuckerberg answered, because the Facebook has never talked about that. But they have said they will never try to influence the outcome of an election. And that's nice to hear. And I'm glad they are saying that now. But I worry about the next guy. Who is the next guy? And what's going to motivate the next guy? Is he going to have financial imperatives to sway our opinions in one way or another? Or maybe political motivations? We don't know that. And there's no way anyone can answer that. But I worry we're going down this road that feels oddly uncomfortable, but could be really scary later. Is that enough? I'm really paranoid.
So, to turning that a little more toward your book, when you were writing, what were your primary concerns that you wanted readers to take away, understanding after reading Terms of Use?
I wanted people to think about these issues, the privacy. And the ability for the potential for abuse and the kind of abuse I was sort of referring to. Our lives are tracked 24/7. I don't know how many people I think people here are a lot more savvy than in the Midwest. When I've done tours in the Midwest, I get some very naive questions from people who don't really understand what's going on. And it's through no fault of their own. They're just not surrounded by the kind of information we see and hear and the people we talk to every day. But our lives are tracked 24/7. Everything we do on our computer, everything we do on our tablet, everything we do on our phone is recorded and stored and analyzed and sliced and diced, et cetera, et cetera. And until recently, it was actually difficult to sort of stitch together everything we did on all these devices. But now they have what they call identity stitching. So they're able to determine that a single person uses this computer and that tablet and the phone over here. And even in cases where two people use the same device, they're able to determine based on their user patterns. It's called probabilistic behavioral analysis, who is actually using the computer at any given time. So they know everything you do, and when you do it, where you go, what you write, what you who you communicate with. I mean, we are getting tracked 24/7, and it's pretty scary. Okay, so that's bad enough. Actually, let me back up. So we're being tracked, and these companies have amassed the greatest stores of information, our data, the world has ever seen. Never before have companies or governments been able to store as much information as these companies have, and it's all about us. And we know that these companies are not impervious to hackers. We've seen Yahoo just got hacked, or just announced that it was hacked a couple of years ago. 500 million people, half its user base, had their information compromised. So they can't protect us the way that they have promised to protect us. So that's one thing I think we should be worried about. But these companies are also investing billions of dollars in artificial intelligence. Do we understand artificial? Machine learning. These are machines that will be able to reason and grasp abstract concepts and sort of think for themselves. And what these companies want to do are create systems that will help us filter information, or will filter information for us, so that it'll help us navigate an increasingly complex world. In the near future, these companies will be able to develop systems so that we can talk to our computer and ask them complex questions, and our computers will talk back to us, not like a Siri, in a much more sophisticated manner. These computers will be able to make suggestions to us unrequested. Just randomly during our day, they'll say, this is on sale over here. You've been shopping for jeans last week, and I found the perfect pair for you based on what you've bought in the past, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these systems will be able to help us make better decisions. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with this, as long as we can always be sure that these for-profit companies always act in our best interests. Ooh, you guys are really cynical. Yeah. But we don't know that, do we? I mean, most of us, I think, don't believe that at all. We can't predict how these companies are going to use our data, because they don't even know. And they'll tell you that. They're trying to figure out what they can do with our data. And what we certainly don't know is how market forces in the future are going to compel them to use our data to make a profit, because that's what they do. It's a competitive industry. They're beholden to shareholders. So think about it. These companies have amassed the greatest stores of information the world has ever seen, and we have no idea how they're going to use it. So remember that bargain I suggested a little earlier that we had made, that tacit bargain? We get free stuff for a couple of ads that we want to see. I mean, it sounds really quaint. It sounds very quaint, I think. So I'm not saying that Facebook is like Enron, and I'm not suggesting that Google is the BP of tech, or that Apple, which is also involved in investing heavily in AI, is like Volkswagen, okay? But, well, no, but I'm not trying to say they're going to do bad things, but we don't know what they might do, and we don't have any transparency into what goes into these algorithms. These algorithms are black boxes, and it's a competitive advantage, so they don't want to share it with us, which is understandable, but given the power these algorithms have, it's scary not to know what's in them. And these companies have very little accountability. And I say very little, and I'm being charitable. How many times a month do you guys get a new terms of use or service agreement from a company that you've been using for many years? And how many times does anyone read them, right? We have a lawyer here who's just saying that they're designed to not be read, correct? Pretty much. They're so long and onerous that...
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways of drafting them, but with time...
Yeah.
They've definitely become longer in length.
Yeah. Yeah.
As the services have become more sophisticated. Mm. But, yeah.
And what we've seen over time is they've expanded their rights. I mean, they're trying to protect themselves, but they've basically given themselves the rights to do as they please with our data. So these are kind of the issues I want people to sort of think about and freak out about.
Is everybody scared yet? Well, that's the book, actually, I'm not giving away too much here. It's why I have written my questions down so that I don't go off script and give away too much in the book. But it begins with a hack. And so it begins with, you know, this reputable social media company being hacked for like the second time ever, and it's a big deal, and it doesn't happen to them, and this is suddenly people are afraid, well, what's going to happen to this data? And here they have this assurance that Scott's talking about, that everyone that we're supposed to trust, that our data is safe. But that's the beginning of the techno thriller that is the book's been called. So it's also called a conspiracy thriller in an international crime novel. But I know you don't like the term techno thriller. So what about that bothers you? Even though I think it's appropriate. It kind of puts you in that place where you know technology is involved, but it's also a thriller.
Yeah, I struggle with that with my publisher. We argued about whether we should call it a techno thriller or not, and they won, as they usually do. No, I was worried that to me, techno thriller sort of suggests a book that you know geeks are going to geek out on. And I wanted to write a book that appealed to everyone, because I wanted to sort of talk about the issues I'm talking about in a sort of an entertaining, engaging, exciting way through this storyline, this political geopolitical storyline. So I was worried that the label would sort of be off-putting to people and scare away people who might not otherwise want to read a tech story. And it's not really a tech story. It is a tech story, but it's about the impact technology has on our broader society. So I went to great lengths to try to find that balance, so I could be true to the technology and to the geeks that were going to read it, but also make it very understandable to people that aren't into technology. And I wanted to balance the sort of the action and the thrilling parts with sort of the big picture issues that we're discussing in this novel. So I was a bit concerned that I would scare off people.
So you mentioned building realistic characters based on what we know about the technology industry, and the main character, Sergio Mansur, could really be any seasoned techie in the Valley. I saw him as a real character. Realistic, based on my own experiences. So tell us a little bit about how you developed him as the hero in the story, because it's usually not the geek that's the hero, so that's kind of a refreshing change.
You know, I don't really know where Sergio came from, frankly. He just sort of popped into my head one night, and it was kind of an odd thing, because that doesn't happen to journalists. We sort of get our stuff from notes and interviews and stuff like that. But it was as I was starting to think about how I was going to tell a story like this. And I think it had to be a geek insider, too. So I could, because none of us would ever really discover a conspiracy at Facebook. We're not there. We're not in the game. So it had to be an insider. So I went to a bunch of coder friends that I've met and known for quite a while, and I asked them if they would help me paint the picture of what it was like. I mean, I've been to a lot of these companies. I've been to the security bunker at Facebook, and I've interviewed a lot of these people. But it's a little different than actually being there day in, day out. Well, one of the things I asked before I the first thing I asked them was would they help me? And I wanted to make clear that what kind of book I was writing, what kind of story I wanted to tell, the message I wanted to get across, because I didn't want them to feel like I was misleading them, and then I come up with a book that they disagreed with. So I laid it all out, and they were so eager for me to write this book because they felt like it was issues that needed to be discussed and a story that needed to be told. So a lot of Sergio is sort of a composite of these coders that I relied on. I spent hours with some of them. I mean, many, many hours, and they reviewed every word I wrote to make sure that I I portrayed their daily lives and the thoughts and the way they viewed data flowing through their heads. It was a really kind of a surprising picture to me, the way that coders see data. I mean, I just thought they'd see numbers on a screen, but they have these four-dimensional matrices floating sort of around this data, pulsing through their heads in real time. And it's kind of a bizarre concept, and I had trouble getting my head around it for a while. But everything that I posit and portray about these coders are in Sergio are real, very real. The other thing I wanted to sort of highlight was sort of a comeuppance. We've all seen, you know, sort of the tech bros that are changing the world, and they're pretty confident about what they're doing, and they think they know better. They think that they know the way forward. But I often wonder, you know, every time one of these companies gets hacked, you know, what that must feel like for them to get beaten. So I wanted to, and then, you know, this to some degree happens to Sergio, and I wanted to portray that in my story too. That sense of I screwed up, and what I thought to be the way forward maybe isn't really the right path, and there might be unintended consequences for everything I've done. So I wanted him to have that kind of moment. And I guess the final thing I'd say about Sergio is he is of Mexican descent. He is the son of immigrants who've done well in the United States. And as an immigrant myself, I'm from Canada. I was an immigrant in Mexico. I'm an immigrant here. I was an immigrant in Asia. And I'm fortunate because I was an immigrant with money. But it's amazing these people that come to the United States. I have a lot of respect because they're taking huge risks. They're very entrepreneurial, and I wanted to sort of honor that. Just because I thought he would be an interesting character. It wasn't anything political. And it turns out it's actually probably a lot more controversial today than when I first started out the book. But that was completely unintended.
So speaking about controversial and the political, without giving too much away, another one of the characters, the Republican candidate for president, is in the book a rather contemptible character. Was there a particular reason you chose to make him a Republican?
Yes. I've actually got some very scathing reviews on Amazon from people that are almost assuredly Republican, who have criticized my book as blatant liberal propaganda. One of the things I've actually admired a lot about Republicanism and Republicans is that they've been very disciplined with their messaging. I mean, you know, on one hand, we can rattle off five words or phrases that would sort of define what a Republican is. You know, law and order, family values, tax cuts, defense, gun rights. It's pretty simple to define what a Republican stands for, at least prior to this election, because I think all bets are off. And the Democratic tent is actually much, much bigger, and it's a lot harder to sort of pin down what a Democrat stands for. You look at Bernie and look at Hillary. I mean, they were all over the map. So I wanted to play off. I hate to use the term stereotype because I try not to make my character a stereotype, but I wanted to play off the Republican stereotype because the character is most assuredly not. And I just found it easier to do. It was kind of a short form. I kind of cribbed it. And also the fact that I refer to China. China plays an important role in the story. The Republicans' hawkish views on China play better as a Republican than as a Democrat. And I actually tried to write it the other way, and it just didn't work as well.
Interesting.
So I wasn't really trying to – I was a bit worried that I'd be alienating some readers by doing this. But otherwise, it wouldn't have seemed as realistic.
We have to pick a party for your candidate, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's got to be one or the other.
Well, some novels don't, and they don't ring as true.
Yeah.
And I felt like I needed to do that.
Interesting. So about China, they do play a role in the book, and as well as rare earths that you went into some detail about, also known as rare earth minerals, rare earth metals. What can you tell us about your thoughts on China and rare earths and why you chose to put those in the book?
I wanted a really complex story. I mean, ultimately, I wanted to sort of expand beyond just the political, and I thought a geopolitical. I also want to introduce a sort of a menace from without, from abroad, to make the story more menacing. And I picked China because I think they are the most significant geopolitical rival. I mean, I know Russia is the boogeyman du jour right now, but I spent a fair bit of time in China and in Taiwan, and I had lots of conversations with people of all ages and walks of life. And I was really struck by a sort of a common theme that, and when we started talking politics, was this sense of Chinese exceptionalism. You talk about American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. Trust me, the Chinese have it in spades. And they talk about, you know, their recession of the last 150 years, which is really, I mean, they look at this, the last period when they were sort of dominated by the colonial powers, as akin to a recession. And because in context of their long history, it was a very short period of time. And I was there in the early 90s before it was obvious that the Chinese emergence was as obvious as it is today. But they were, to a T, most assured that they were back on their knees and standing up, and they were going to be back as a dominant world power. They play an incredibly long view, and the long game, and have a long view of history, so I think long term they are still the geopolitical rival that the U.S. will have to contend with the most, and it just so happens that they dominate this industry called rare earths. I don't know how many people have heard of that. Rare earth minerals or metals are a byproduct of iron ore mining and other things like this, and they're found in extremely low concentrations, and they're very toxic, and they require a lot of processing that's very expensive to do. But it just so happens that these rare earth metals, when they're refined and processed into minerals, are essential for just about every technological product that we use today. They provide the coloring in TV screens. They're necessary for magnets in speakers. They are essential in the missile guidance systems on nuclear missiles. Without rare earth minerals, we wouldn't have a high-tech industry. And China basically rules that industry. They've acquired the technology. They've invested in the processing systems and equipment and the know-how. They control somewhere in the neighborhood of 50-6% of the world's supply. They have so much clout they can push the price up or slash the price depending on which way the wind's blowing, and they've done it. And the DOD is concerned enough that they've written papers about this. There are bills in Congress trying to sort of kickstart the U.S. economy. But I wanted to highlight this issue because I think it also, again, plays to that fear of a foreign power impacting us, and it just lent itself very well to the story.
Yeah, and for those who don't know about China's background in terms of, they're very well known for being such adept hackers and these big networks of hackers, huge groups of hackers that have planted bots in our networks that have been there for years, to the point that if we were to remove them all, it would cripple our networks. So we just go on, the government knows they're there, and the companies know they're there, and they leave them there.
I haven't heard this. They will cripple our networks?
Well, it would be challenging to remove them, and it's one of those whack-a-mole, you know, situations. So it's kind of accepted that they're there. But you know, we can talk about the NSA hacking or spying on us, but the Chinese are also already in our networks, probably listening to this recording. So
They'll have the podcast very soon.
But that's one of the reasons that China is also very fascinating as an adversary in this respect. So we just have a couple minutes. I'm going to drop to my last question, and we'll open it up to the audience. Common things that I read when I looked at the reviews about terms of use was, quote, "You'll never look at social media the same way again." And I thought that was fascinating. How does that make you feel? Is that your hope that readers will take away from this experience?
Yes. I mean, in a word, yes. I would like them to say it was a great story, and I'll never. But yeah, no, that was what I hoped to do. That was sort of what sort of propelled me on this journey to write this novel. So it's gratifying to see that, actually, that make people think. I don't know that we can completely turn off social media. We certainly can't get off the internet. So we need to start thinking about different ways that we might want to interact with the internet and different business models maybe that these companies should be required to adopt or forced to adopt, whether by market forces or regulation or, should we be paying for our privacy? Should we, back away from this free service in exchange for our data? These are kinds of questions that I hope people start talking about, because I think we need to, as a society, think through where we're going. So to hear people actually thinking about these issues, it's good to hear. Yes.
Right.
Well, thank you very much.
It's time for Q&A. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, anyone who has a question, so one right here.
We'll start with you.
I've read that in addition to auto spell check, Google has created a fact check that we can opt to use to make sure our letters and papers are accurate. Do you know about Google's fact check?
Do you?
Check?
I don't know. I've never heard of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
You're going to use it in the presidential debates? Or? I'd like to remind our listeners online that they're listening to Sarah Granger interview Scott Allen Morrison, the author of Terms of Use, a novel, which investigates the dark side of social media. And we're in the middle of Q&A here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Next question.
Your novel identifies a specific conspiracy from a specific place. But in the real world, is there any doubt in your mind that such a manipulation is not occurring without a specific bad guy and without being a conspiracy?
I'm not clear.
Well, you're talking about influence occurring because of this, the things that happen. There's a conspiracy. And it's people being manipulated to vote for a presidential candidate. So is there any, is it possible, I guess, or is it probable that what you're describing is occurring right now?
It has occurred. Certainly in other countries it has occurred. There is a famous, actually infamous hacker. He's gone public, and he's spoken to journalists about his efforts to influence elections in South America, and we've seen it. We're seeing it to some degree here. There are Twitter bots, and I can't imagine that there aren't social bots on Facebook, trying to influence what we see and what we don't see, and what we think and what we don't think, and who we're going to vote for and who we won't vote for. So yes, is it a concerted conspiracy the way I portray it? I hope not here. Can I say for sure that it's not happening? No. But it certainly has happened in other countries. It's very realistic and very, I think it's only a matter of time before it happens here.
We talk about the difference between the form. The form we have is the internet, social media, and so on. You can go back to journalism, since you're journalists, and the publishers that have certain approaches to try to influence everyone to think, so that there's the right-wing newspapers and there's the left-wing newspapers. So people have been having their opinions manipulated by other technologies for a long time. So I understand that this seems to have a lot more information about us, and they can tailor it personally, just the way ads. But you can always say no to an ad. What's the difference? Why is this even scarier than really slanted journalism that influenced lots of things?
I think first of all, you know when you watch a Fox News or a CNBC that what you're getting. You go there for a specific slant. And they are open about the fact that they do this. Facebook maintains to this day that they're a neutral platform. Now, whether or not that's in fact the case, I mean, that's you can debate that till the cows come home. A lot of people don't think that's the case. The company says it is. But it's not just the ads you see. And it's not just the news that you see or don't see on Facebook. It's the conglomeration of everything that's on that site in your news feed. Your friends telling you things that and supporting points of view, the memes that you see. I mean, you get flooded with such a degree, such an amount of information that is one-sided that it's I think we're all susceptible to that kind of bombardment. And we often get lazy and we don't look beyond. And it's getting easier and easier now to have it come to us instead of us going to the newsstand and looking at all the headlines. And that's, I think, the real difference.
There's something else that's going on the social media that I think is interesting. It happens probably to almost everybody, where they say, so-and-so wants to be friends with you on Facebook. So-and-so wants to link in with you on LinkedIn. And I've asked several people who I knew did not ask for this, and they said, no, I never asked for this. So they're using algorithms to tell you that people who know three other people that you know. And it's very much, it reminds me of magazines that try to increase their circulation because then their ad rates can go up. And so I figured it must be based upon the same principle. But are there other things like that? I mean, I'm guessing that's happening. If you know, that's great. But there are lots of other things like that going on that are inaccurate, that are being presented so personally. That are not personal.
A central element to my book is what are known as social bots, and I don't know how many people know what a social bot is, but it's a piece of code, a program that is designed to act and interact like a real person. And the initial social bots weren't very good, and they weren't very convincing. In fact, they're still not, but they're getting better, much, much better, to the point now that the technology is good enough for Facebook itself to use chat bots to interact with us commercially. So they introduced earlier this year this new chatbot service so that, for example, the example they used, that if you wanted to buy flowers online, you could go to the account for the flower company, and then you could chat with them on a message and say, I'd like to buy some flowers. And then they would come back to you and say, oh, you know, what would you like? And then you'd say, I want a dozen roses. And they say, where can I deliver them? And you would do this in a messaging in Facebook Messenger. And this was not a real person. This was a chat bot. So I think often you are getting requests from maybe not people. I mean, we all get those requests from people that we have no idea who they are. And it could very well be a social bot. Facebook is very concerned about social bots, as is Twitter, et cetera, et cetera.
As they should be.
As they should be.
So in every one of these instances, the user has a choice. And you have a choice not to put information in. In some cases, by virtue of the terms of use, you're signing up for, if you don't say yes, you just don't get to play on Apple's, you know, different applications and that sort of thing. So there is, you know, I mean, there are ways that individuals can, you know, make the choices as to what information they make available. They can also filter the kinds of things that they do or you know, make choices as to what you do on Facebook. I mean, personally, I'm fairly savvy, I would guess. I'm not the most savvy, but there's, you know, I feel that, you know, when I go out there, I make choices, and I, with somewhat intelligent choices, and I still get, you know, I had my Google account hacked from some guy in Nigeria a couple of years ago, and it was a pain in the ass. But
was he a prince?
No, but they, you know, he's.
But he had lots of money to give you, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, but you know, that's I more or less take that as a fact of life, because I get so much use out of the various tools that are available to me. On Facebook, on the Messenger, on, I mean, half of the New York Times articles that I read come to me through Facebook, which is fine because I subscribe to the New York Times anyway. So I don't see that as the issue. What should we be doing in that kind of a situation?
Well, to not share data with these companies, you would have to not use the internet, period. I mean, every time you go on the internet, no matter whether it's Facebook or any other site, whatever search you do, I mean, everything you do is tracked. Every time you leave the house with your phone, do you have location services on your phone? So it knows everywhere you go. All that is data that gets collected about you. So it knows your patterns. I mean, it knows a lot more about you than you realize. And I say it, I'm talking about the services. And I'm lumping them all together. But
I make that assumption.
Yeah. I don't know that we don't know what they're going to do with this data. So you're making a bargain that you don't know what the other end of the bargain is. You don't know how they're going to use your data in 5 years or 10 years. You don't know what commercial imperative they will have to exploit your data in ways that may or may not be in your advantage. And they might not, but we don't know this. And that's, I think, the point I'm really trying to get to. We don't know what the next guy is going to do down the road. And as we embed ourselves more and more on the internet, it's getting to the point where we really can't live without the internet. And it's going to get even harder to do so. You know, but we're making this bargain that we don't understand what the other half of the bargain is. And that I think is we should think about, we should be concerned about. And if we could make a bargain, would you be willing to pay a little bit for these services and know that your privacy was 100% guaranteed? And I know that's kind of a hard thing to... You don't care?
No, it ain't going to happen.
Well,
well, technology to know that that's not going to happen.
What's not going to happen?
That you're guaranteed, 100% guaranteed.
Well, yeah, okay, but if they couldn't exploit your data for commercial purposes,
yeah,
would you be willing to say, I am willing to pay a little bit of money so that they will erase my data as soon as I give it to them, for example? That's simplistic, but, you know, should we have that option? Should we talk about that option?
It's interesting from the legal point of view. People worry about contracts and saying, and a lot of CEOs say, "I would never do that." So we're not worried about you. We're worried about the next guy who's CEO of your company. And you're kind of arguing the same thing here. And we had a speaker in here a year ago or so, speaking about the Ukraine, and he said that the people who demonstrated in the Ukraine against the government got a message on their cell phones, saying in the square while they were demonstrating, saying, "We know you're there, we have you all on video. I mean, we have you all on picture, and we know that you're there because your cell phones are there." So just like if someone sent us a message right now, so we all know you're at the Commonwealth Club listening to Scott talk about this.
Yeah, that's subversive, Scott Morrison.
Yeah. So I think that's part of what you're saying. It's who's going to take over next, and what are they going to do with the information?
I have a comment and a question. Firstly, my comment is that as you express the concern about companies like Facebook, Google, Twitter, et cetera, harvesting data that they accrue from feedback that you put into their system, I think that you will increasingly see that as more and more devices are connected to the internet, that capability is also empowered to companies like Ford, GM, et cetera. Traditional hard companies that have sold hardware devices will be able to harvest a whole wealth of data about
To say nothing of all the ad tech companies, the advertising technology companies that we have no idea. There's scores of them, and we have no idea what they're called, and they come and they go, and that data, we have no idea who has it, what they do with it, and where it goes, and who they sell it to. There are so many people that have control of data that we leave, the digital breadcrumbs that we leave behind. We can't even count the numbers of and the types of companies, and you're correct. Wait, and you had a question?
So my question is, while I find the notion that Facebook employees want to understand how they can throw the election to be a bit repugnant, I'd like to understand how you think that differentiates, or if it differentiates, from the notion that someone like ExxonMobil or Chevron could pay a team of lawyers and lobbyists to go after political candidates and sway their opinion in favor of relaxing EPA guidelines or so on. How do you distinguish and differentiate the kind of grassroots approach that is social media and Facebook versus the strategic targeted approach of more traditional companies?
Well, okay.
That's a good one.
That's a good one to unpack.
We're almost out of time.
Yeah. We're out of time. Sorry.
Sorry, there's time for that one.
You're not going to try and answer that question?
No. No. I have to think about that. And I'm happy to chat with you afterwards. But I mean, I think sort of what corporations do in lobbying and they do it often sort of in the shadows, I find that equally repugnant. So,
I guess as I think about our current, having read your book and then having seen the news of Russia hacking the DNC and sort of trying to influence the election through that hack, and while the Republican candidate simultaneously sort of singing the praises of the, you know, head of the Russian government, it was a shocking sort of set of parallels. I know you didn't see it coming. I certainly didn't see it coming. But I also reflect on the fact that Donald Trump exists mainly because of Rupert Murdoch and his empire. Yeah. Brexit. You name any number of sort of big things that have happened over the last, say, 10 or 15 years, and you can see that the larger Murdoch empire has played a role. And in fact, that old-timey media, newspapers, broadcasting entities, of course, online entities, reach about as many people as Facebook reaches, right? And so my sense is that there have been, you know, sort of nefarious actors at work, people who are pulling the levers of our opinions at work. And in fact, before social media, the credit card companies knew about as much as, you know, as anybody does about us. They knew where we traveled. They knew what they could discern our preferences. Your mailbox at home, your snail mailbox at home, is flooded with all the choices you've ever made based on your credit card behavior. So, you know, my sense is that we gave up control of our information a very long time ago. It just now has a very new dimension. So I'm wondering to what degree, you know, we should be afraid of a vast new dimension, or are we just merely sort of in the next phase? I mean, here you are, a former journalist, now novelist, at the former Press Club, now Commonwealth Club. And, you know, we are all sort of talking about this great new menace, which feels a lot like the great old menace, which then actually produced the menace called, in my opinion, Donald Trump. So, you know, I what is really new here?
What is really new here? I think it was... I can't remember his initials. Woolworth, the guy that founded Woolworth, said that you know, half my advertising budget is wasted. I just don't know which half. he actually said that. So yes, there's always been the attempt to influence us, but I think now these systems are so much more refined, and they can target us in ways, and they can really push our hot buttons in a way that a lot of these other systems that, you know, TV ads on TV was sort of, you know, it's a scattershot approach. And I think that's what we've seen in the past. It works. I think social media and the targeting that's possible online, I think is far more powerful and potentially more abusive. So I think it's amplified. It's not different, it's amplified, and I think we have to be aware of that, and I think I find it a scarier world than we used to live in.
Is it amplified or it's trumped up?
Trumped up, there we go.
Well, also getting back to this question, I think part of it is the lack of transparency and how embedded, I mean, 120 years ago or whatever, William Randolph Hearst was accused of trying to foster and foment, agitate to sort of, spur people on to the Spanish-American War. And I think, you know, that was at that time probably less transparent than, say, a Fox News or something is now. I think it's true that a lot of the media is known to be editorial. And that is something that I think is a little less repugnant if you know that bias and you know you're feeding, you're being, you're getting delivery of an editorial. Whereas I think something like social media, certainly Facebook, is so prevalent, and behind the scenes, whether it's artificial intelligence or whatever, it's complete lack of transparency for most people that I think is probably as nefarious as it gets. So that, to me, I think we're hitting a whole new level of lack of transparency and embeddedness into our lives. So.
By a platform that's supposed to, that purports to be neutral. And I find that, you know, it's a stretch, to say the least.
So we have time for one or two more questions.
This is probably for Sarah. Hillary announced she was putting people, paid staff, on Reddit. I would guess that that's going to be a trend in the future, which corrupts further our common square. Are you seeing that? Is that becoming like, oh, good idea, Hillary, now we have a new way of influencing the common square?
Well, there are paid staffers on many campaigns on various forms of social media, and Reddit is a can of worms in itself. I think to what Scott was saying earlier about the social bots, we're in a place now where any kind of conversation, whether it's on San Francisco Chronicle, SF Gate site, where I used to blog, and the comments were unmoderated, and so we could get all kinds of trolls on there, and those can be people who are paid or not paid. It's a lot of the time there are people out there who are doing these things, and you don't know where they're coming from. So, you know, it's happening in all kinds of different places, and whether it's going to be skewed or not, I think it's happening everywhere, and it's not necessarily different than the commentators that go on to Fox News to give their views, for example. You have other.
Will these Clinton employees be identify as Clinton employees? Will we know who they are?
No, they weren't clear, but they would say the same thing. So we got a flood all of a sudden as of one date of, you know, a handful of people. And if you track them, oh, they just joined Reddit. They weren't long-term Redditors. And they were saying the same thing, but they had different posting names.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well,
so it was kind of like, is this one of Hillary's employees? And then you would go check at what date did they join Reddit, and it was obvious.
Yeah.
Well, there's also the question of paid versus unpaid, and a lot of the time you're going to get people who are volunteers for campaigns doing the same kind of thing, and whether they're officially given the okay to do that or not is another murky place. So this is all new, and it's interesting to hear. I hadn't heard that, but it's good that you can pay attention to when they joined, and that's an important feature, at least to the transparency point. If you have that kind of information, it's helpful for the users to know that this is a new scam. If you're on Twitter and all of a sudden there are people trolling you and saying all this stuff, and you look and, oh, the account was just created last week, well, that tells you something.
Yeah. Right. Time for the last question.
So I'd like to direct this question to both of you. We've talked a lot about being aware and so forth, but what specific controls would you advocate to counter some of this?
I sort of joke, but I'm not really joking when I say I don't know that much is going to happen. One answer is regulation, right? I mean, and I don't know that regulation. I don't think regulation is the right. The right answer, because it can't keep up with the pace of technological change. But there might come a moment when a senator is exposed online and gets outraged. And we saw this, I think, was it Thomas with the video records, the Supreme Court, when an enterprising journalist.
Clarence Thomas.
An enterprising journalist went to his video store and found out that he was renting pornographic videos and put this in the story. And then your video rental records are the safest thing online because of that. They're absolutely, and Netflix has a it's a big deal for Netflix because they're scared to death that anyone's records will leak because there is a specific law prohibiting it because of that. So at some point, there's going to be a senator that gets exposed, and I worry that that's going to make things even worse because they're going to try to regulate this. There is new technology out there called blockchain. It is the basis for the Bitcoin currency. They use something called homomorphic encryption, which enables data to be processed while encrypted, et cetera, et cetera. I don't quite understand it. I certainly couldn't explain it today. But that is one possible solution to keeping our data protected and unusable to other parties. So there are people that are working on this as an alternative. So there could very well be a technological an advance that is the solution going forward. I think that's what it's going to come down to. But that will require a different market, a business model for these companies. Because if they can't use our data to sell and make money off of, we're going to have to pay for that privacy.
So sort of like the war between Facebook and Adblock.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think Tor works?
Depends who you're trying to hide from. So, the NSA has hacked Tor. That's not going to protect you from the NSA. In fact, if you use Tor, I've been told by security people that that just is a red flag. It's like a cape for the NSA. They're going to come looking for you. So depends what you're trying to hide from.
But I do, as a quick follow-up, I agree with what Scott said, but I would, for everyone who's interested in the encryption topic, to just keep tabs on this one because it's only becoming a bigger issue because the government, FBI in particular, has been trying to clamp down on encryption, yet encryption is one of the things that really that will help companies protect our data and help users protect our data. So, but at the same time, they want to be able to help catch the criminals, and so it's an interesting dialogue. I won't go any farther than that with it. But I would suggest keeping a lookout for what's happening with that.
That was the Apple. There was an Apple phone that was used in San Bernardino that was encrypted, and they were telling the crackers that the Apple didn't want that.
Yeah.
I ran into something new the other day for encryption. They said that you have to pick not only your security question but also your security answer from the following list so that nobody can follow exactly how you typed it out, so that you can't they can't get your typed out answer. So they were worried about somebody following
the keystroke loggers.
The keystrokes, but if you don't do the keystrokes, you just pick something, then they'd have to do is have the knowledge of the what's on the list in the first place and how far down the list you went. So I didn't know how that fixed it, but I thought it was an interesting, how scared they're getting about the encryption. So thank you very, very much. That was a very interesting, discussion about things, all from a novel, which is really quite something. So thank you very much, Scott.
And thank you.
And so ends another event in the Commonwealth Club's 115-year history of enlightened discussion. Thank you.